Hi, I'm Tedra Meyer, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. With warm weather sweeping the state and flower buds popping up everywhere, you really can't walk too far without seeing a buzzing bee. Vermont is home to more than 300 bee species that pollinate everything from highbush blueberries to apple orchards. But many bee species in Vermont are dying in droves, threatened by climate change, pesticides, and diseases. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to discuss these threats and how Vermonters can support bees, from responsibly maintaining hives at home to avoiding certain products in gardens and farms. We'll also talk about a bill that would have banned seeds coated in pesticides that beekeepers say are killing their bees. Dairy farmers, however, say they rely on those seeds to grow corn for their cows. Then, later in the hour, we'll hear from the author and Middlebury writing professor Megan Mayhew Bergman about her new book of short fiction, How Strange a Season, and the art of weaving themes of climate change into fiction. But first, the bees. We are joined today by two bee experts. First, Spencer Hardy is a bee biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. Spencer, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
We're also joined today by Chaz Mraz, a third-generation beekeeper at Champlain Valley Apiaries in Middlebury. His grandfather founded the apiaries back in 1931. Chaz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, have you thought about being a hobbyist beekeeper and have some questions? Do you want to know the best plants to help pollinators in your yard? Join the conversation. We have our phone lines open today, and that number is 800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.org or tweet us at Vermont Edition. Now, Spencer and Chaz, we have already gotten a lot of emails from listeners, and a number of them kind of ask the same question, and it's whether keeping honeybees actually does anything to, quote unquote, save the bees. One person compared it to keeping chickens to save the birds. So the question here is beekeeping actually good for bees overall in the state? And Spencer, let's start with you.
Yeah, that's an astute question, and I think it's something we can talk about a bunch. But Vermont has something like 350 native bee species, mm-hmm. Honeybees being an introduced species in North America. And there's positives and negatives, I guess, that we could talk about. But there's definitely some evidence that there's spillover of pathogens and various diseases from managed honeybees into wild bee populations with potentially detrimental effects.
So sorry, when you say that there are pathogens that could spill over, what exactly does that mean? Is that honeybees are getting sick and then passing on diseases to native bees?
Yeah, so the honeybees, as I understand it, are carrying, or potentially carrying a number of viruses that they basically leave on the flowers as they're foraging. And some studies have shown that bumblebees can pick those up off the flowers and become infected that way. But there's not a lot of research on direct interactions between honeybees and wild bees at the landscape level. It's still an open area of inquiry.
Okay. And Chaz, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this as somebody who, runs apiaries, but also clearly, cares about bees and the native populations here. How do you see those two interacting?
Yes, I care very much so. And the way I see it interacting is the commercial or managed bees by a hobbyist or by a commercial beekeeper, they're really an indicator for us what's going on in our environment. And they're of course important for commercial pollination, the way we grow food and things. We can't rely solely on native pollinators, but the viruses and things that the bees are exhibiting are really a result of the environment they're living in. And if we had healthy bees, and a more healthy environment, they wouldn't be exhibiting these viruses that they may or may not be spreading to native pollinators. It's certainly a risk, but we have to look at what the problem, the overall problem really is. I mean, this is an introduced species, of course, but they've been here since pretty much the Mayflower. So they've been in the United States a long time, living side by side with our pollinators without, I don't think, any specifically negative impact.
So you said we have to look specifically at what the problem is. To you, what is that problem?
Well, the problem in the science and is pointing that the real problem is agrochemicals out there that are affecting the overall health of the bees. And there's, you know, many parts of that, but there is a particular part of it which is pretty much unnecessary. It's of little to no benefit to the farmers, but it's being used prophylactically, and that's coating the corn and soybean seeds with neonicotinoid pesticides. And they've been doing it for the last 20 years or so. And though our whole industry has turned on its head since this time, and there's a incredible amount of science that shows the damage this is doing, and it's the reason the EU as a whole banned these practices, but we continue to do them here, and we're suffering the consequences throughout the whole country and many other parts of the world. And the reason I focus on this is, you know, I understand we need pesticides in agriculture and modern agriculture, and I really think that commercial agriculture and bees can live side by side, but there's an abusive practice out there that is a little to no benefit to the farmers. It's benefiting the chemical companies who make the product, but it's really a mass poisoning of our country and our state. There's 93 million acres planted every year with these chemicals in the United States, 93 or 97, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. And they're really an unnecessary approach. And they weren't asked for by the farmers. The farmers simply ordered their commercial seed and they started coming coated with these neonicotinoid and systemic pesticides.
Well, I want to jump in here, Chaz, because you're alluding in part to a recent bill in Vermont that would have banned seeds covered in these types of pesticides that you're talking about. But as we mentioned, a number of dairy farmers in the state pushed back on it because they said they are really relying on those seeds to grow corn for their cows in some pretty difficult growing conditions. And Chaz, you testified before state lawmakers on this bill, and it's kind of ended up as something of a compromise bill, and it's on its way to the governor right now. And essentially, it requires the Vermont government to institute voluntary best management practices for these seeds by March 2024. And I heard that phrase, and I was like, what exactly does that mean? So from your perspective, do these voluntary best management practices, would they actually do anything to protect bees?
No, they won't. Nothing at all. And I sat at the same desk I'm at now and helped with my representatives, helped write the original bill. And this bill was taken in the Vermont House and rewritten by basically a state employee and then passed on. And it's really, I just this morning wrote to the governor to let him know that I no longer support the bill. It's basically a bill to say we're going to go on as normal and we're not going to do anything about the problem. And then they'll look back at it and say, well, look, we passed this bill, we're addressing the issue, and we're not. This is a bill with absolutely no teeth in it at all and is not going to address the problem, and it's just going to allow the problem to continue.
Well, Spencer, I'd love to hear from you here. What do you think the state could be doing to protect bees in Vermont?
Yeah, I think neonicotinoids are obviously a big concern for both wild and cultivated bees. But I think with the case with the wild bees, which I've been studying for the last 3 or 4 years, it's really a death by a thousand cuts, and there's a million things that are harming individuals and bee populations across the state. And agriculture obviously is an important part of a lot of large portions of the state, and it has its place. But I,
can you name a couple of those? You mentioned death by a thousand cuts. What are some of those cuts? Maybe ones that listeners could avoid.
The main one that right now that I think is worth focusing on is habitat in small residential lots and at a broader scale across the state, where we've got all this land that's used for lawns and for recreation that I think could be improved in terms of habitat for both wild and cultivated bees. Things like planting shrubs along the edge of your lawn or mowing a smaller area of your lawn can go a long way in providing resources for honeybees as well as the wild species that are here.
I've been hearing about this thing called No Mow May. Is that related?
Yeah, this is I believe it came out of Britain a few years ago, and it's getting a lot of traction in the U.S. right now. Basically, the idea is if you don't mow your lawn for the month of May, all these wildflowers and weeds, dandelions and introduced species, are able to flower, providing a abundant resource for early season pollen and nectar for bees and other flower visitors.
Well, we have a number of calls coming in, so let's go to the phones and start with Monica in Burlington. Monica, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. When I was a kid, my dad had in the house an observation beehive, which people probably don't know what that is. It was a single frame of like a beehive with inside a sandwich between two pieces of plexiglass. And then there was a tube. The bees lived in there, and there was a little tube so that the bees could go through the tube outside of the house and fly around and do their business and come back. And so we could see the bees like coming back and doing their dances, and the queen laying her eggs and all the goings on in the hive. It was absolutely fascinating, and it gave me such a love for bees. And I don't know that much about bees nowadays in general, but it just gave me this deep love for bees. And so I'm really interested in the show, and I just wanted to put out there and hear your guest comments about how maybe families might think about getting an observation beehive for their to develop this kind of love for bees in their children.
That's great. Thanks, Monica. It sounds like something of an ant farm for bees that kids can look at and learn from. Well, Chaz, as a third generation beekeeper, how did you fall in love with bees and decide to stay in the family business?
Well, I wasn't always in the family business, but came home to take it over from my father. Of course, I worked in the bees in high school and different times all through my life, so I was pretty familiar with them. It's kind of, you know, a family tradition, I guess you could say. Yes, the bees are amazing creatures. We've learned so much about them, and we probably, you know, of all the times we've kept them and learned about them, they're still at least that much we still don't know about that managed honeybee, probably. So they continuously, you know, supply us with information and teach us things about the world around us.
And Spencer, what are your tips for somebody who might want to introduce their kids to the world of wild bees in Vermont? How would they do that safely?
Yeah, it's a fascinating world, and I think it's there's a lot of misconceptions about bees being dangerous stinging insects that should be sprayed and avoided at all costs. Only maybe half of the bee species in Vermont are large enough to be able to sting a human, and very few of them are aggressive enough to have any interest in stinging you unless you step on them or squeeze them, unlike some yellow jackets and some other stinging insects that get most of the blame. But there's things called bee hotels, basically a wooden block with some holes or a collection of hollow reeds that you can place in your garden or in your yard. And those will attract a variety of cavity nesting bees and wasps and other insects that can, it's a great way to put them in a predictable place and be able to observe them building their nests and seeing them, what they do, which I think is a great step in getting people excited about and just noticing the diversity of bees in their backyard.
Now, I want to bring one more voice into this conversation. Becca Warple is a beekeeper at Golden Dog Farms in Jeffersonville and a relatively new beekeeper. Becca, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So can you tell us a little bit about your beekeeping journey? How did you get into this?
Well, I'm new to it. During COVID, we moved to Vermont and bought a farm that had hives on it. And we have lots of apple trees and pear trees and peaches and plums and cherries. And we knew we needed to have the bees for pollination. So I knew I needed to learn to be a beekeeper. And last year was my first year of keeping bees. We had 6 hives. So I've been through one season and didn't have any success over the winter at all. So this year we've gone for it even stronger and have 10 hives. But we also have something that's rather unique on the property that's called a Slovenian bee house. And so I'm also learning how to keep bees in the Slovenian bee house too. So we have 10 hives there. So we've got 20 now.
What is a Slovenian bee house?
Well, you've got, in beekeeping, you've got the traditional Langstroth hives, which are the stacked hives that you see across the U.S. It's you have boxes stacked up tall vertically, and a Slovenian bee house is, can house, well, ours can house up to, I think, 16 hives, but basically if you picture a cabin or a little cottage where one wall of the house is full of beehives. And so the bees can fly in and out of the side of the house, if you will. And as a beekeeper, you access the hives to get the frames and whatnot from within the house. And you're pulling the frames out like books rather than lifting the frames out as you would with a Langstroth hive. Mm. So it tends to be easier for a beekeeper in terms of lifting because you're not having to lift. And we're hoping perhaps it might help our bees winter better because they're more protected with the hives sort of protected by the house. Mm-hmm. As a beekeeper, it's hard. There's a lot of things that are against us. And, you know, we've got bears in the area and wildlife. And then on top, you know, there are mites that bees can get. And managing the bees can be tricky, keeping them from swarming and things like that.
And you mentioned that the winter did not go well. Can you tell us the scope of that? How many bees did you lose?
Oh, my goodness. Well, all of them. Oh. I had 6 hives, and, you know, the hives were doing really well during the summer. And so towards the end of the summer, the worry is, do they have enough food? So as a first year beekeeper, you're starting fresh and the bees are building their frames out. And so that things are kind of delayed, I guess. So as a first year beekeeper, you don't generally want to harvest your honey because the bees will need that food to survive the winter. So that was, I prepared the hives. I didn't harvest much honey. And we had, you know, the 6 hives going strong going into the winter. But probably in December, I noticed there wasn't much activity. In the winter, if you see bees that are dead near the entrance of the hive, that's a good thing. It means that the bees have been working and they're kind of cleaning house. But when you see nothing in the entrance, then you know something's wrong. So in the spring, when I started to kind of take the hives apart and look at them, you want to sort of evaluate, okay, what was going on in the hive? And in my case, I had several frames where the bees were like nose deep into the cells and as if they were eating honey and they just were there, like stuck there, which probably means, and the experts you have on the phone know so much more than I do, but it probably means that they froze, like that the weather, the fluctuations that we had temperature-wise may have killed them. Like it got warm one day, the bees spread out, in the hive, and then the temperature dropped and they couldn't get back together to cluster to keep warm.
Well, Chaz Mraz, you've been involved with apiaries your entire life. Do you have any thoughts or guidance on what might have happened here that you could offer?
Yes. Well, it's actually an indication that the bees starved. And the bees can starve on honey, which is what we refer to it as, is if the temperatures are too low and the cluster is not healthy enough, strong enough to maintain the heat in the hive, then they can't move to the honey that might be there. So whether the beekeeper did have enough honey or not, if you don't have a strong enough, healthy enough cluster to keep that warm, you got to realize the center of the cluster is like about the human temperature, 97 degrees. And if the cluster, what's been happening with a lot of the dieouts is the bees are crashing, their populations are crashing. And then you end up with a cluster that can't maintain temperature in the hive. But when you do see bees head in, you know, in the comb, that is an indication that they starve. Now they may have starved for lack of honey completely, or they may have starved because the cluster was weak, couldn't maintain heat, and they couldn't move to the honey that might have been available there.
Well, Becca, before we let you go, I heard that following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that you've been using your hives to fundraise for Ukrainians. Could you tell us a little bit about those efforts?
Yeah, well, as I was preparing for the newbie packages that were arriving, I started painting the hives, and I thought, you know, I got to paint these blue and yellow and do something to help the people in Ukraine. We're watching it unfold, and it's hard, and you feel like you can't do much. So I decided, and there are many people who are following what we're doing with our beekeeping. I tend to write a lot on our Facebook page. And so people are following along as we're figuring things out on the farm. And so what we did this year is we had 6 hives initially, and I decided to offer the opportunity for people to sponsor the hives, where they would get biweekly updates throughout the summer of their hive and would also get a jar of honey from the hive. And so each of the hives were named after one, like one is joy, one is hope, one is peace, one is love. And so for $50, people could sponsor a hive, and we had up to 10 sponsorships per hive. And it was amazing. Within 48 hours, all the sponsorships had sold. And then what we did also, because people still were inquiring, and it's a fundraiser for Ukraine, and actually we're giving the money to CARE, the organization that is working on the ground with people in the Ukraine. But we now are offering for $25, people can sponsor, get the biweekly updates of the hives as a sponsorship. So it's on our webpage, which is goldendogfarm.com. But it was just something we wanted to do to make a difference. And so the hives are blue and yellow, and it's our Ukrainian village.
That's great. Well, Becca Werpel, a beekeeper at Golden Dog Farms in Jeffersonville, thanks so much for sharing your stories with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's go back to the phones with Michael in Windsor. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Vermont Edition. The question or the topic I wanted to raise was actually brought up right before your break, and Spencer answered some of it, and I hope he or we could elaborate on it. But
sure.
I was going to ask, what could we do to support the native solitary bees, the ones that don't live in a hive but live alone, like the blue orchard bee and the mason bee? And it sounded like Spencer was saying that was a good thing to do, and so that I was happy to hear that. We in Windsor found out that it's actually a good thing to do with kids. So the Windsor Library does a project. The children's librarian builds the tube nest with kids, and then they get to take a tube nest with them, and they put it up wherever they want or where they live, and most of them have been filled, and it's really neat for them to watch. So the materials that we use it has kind of another irony to it, but we harvest the stems of the invasive plant Phragmites, that feathery plume plant you see in wet areas, and you cut them, and you leave a note on one end, and you cut it the right length, and there are instructions on that. On the internet, and the Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S.
Michael, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to cut you off because I want to make sure that we can get an answer to your question about supporting bee populations here. Spencer, you mentioned No Mow May, leaving detritus in your yard to attract bees in the fall. What are some other ways that people can support wild bees in Vermont?
Yeah. I'm just going to quickly mention something that Michael talked about, these bee hotels. I think they're a great educational tool, a great way to get people excited about bees. I think it's worth being a little bit careful about them. If they're too large and in one place for too long, they can attract a variety of molds and parasites and other diseases that potentially harm any occupants. So it's worth keeping them small and short-lived, a season or two, and then once they're empty, composting them and starting new ones. But I think it's a great tool for people to get excited about it. And yeah, these bees are nesting habitat is an important part that's often overlooked in this conversation. I think 12% of our native species nest in these cavities, and it could be as simple as a broken off raspberry cane in your garden. Could be a rotten log on the forest floor. So these are things that we can leave a messy yard, and that helps these species have places to nest. Another large portion of the species in Vermont are ground nesting species that need some variation of bare soil, either sandy or some loose soil where they can dig a burrow and raise their young. So that's something you can think about in your backyard as well.
What about some specific types of plants that people could plant in their gardens or yards?
Yeah. Lately, I've been advocating for shrubs as a great pollinator habitat that also supports caterpillars and then birds and insect-eating birds. So native is always better, almost always better, both for the bees and for caterpillars and other plant-eating insects. Willows are a great option. There's 6 or 7 species of bees in Vermont that only survive on willow pollen, and they're only active when the willows are blooming in the spring. Dogwoods, blueberries, currants, sumac, any of these flowering shrubs are likely provide flowers, resources, and as well as nesting sites for a variety of native bees.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have a comment from Mark in Burlington. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. How are you doing? So I have an interesting experience of being a beekeeper in the New North End of Burlington. And as you know, most of the plots here are maybe at most, I'm up to a third of an acre, but down to a fifth of an acre. And the issue here is we're starting to get folks realizing the importance of, you know, having pollinators, letting nature take its course, but some of it has been taken personal lobbying with neighbors. I won't go into details because two things that are really impacting the bees. And one year I did a pesticide poisoning with my bees. As long as they allow the sale of these particular pesticides or pesticide resistant treated seeds at our hardware stores, we're going to have major crashes, whether it's for those of us raising honeybees or any types of bees. And technically, you know, I think it's generally acknowledged that roughly bees will cover up to a 3-square-mile area. So when I do sell my honey, and I'm at farmers markets very briefly, I can't assure that it's organic because the likelihood is those bees have crossed paths and have gotten nectar from these flowers, and I just think that we need to reinforce and think about what a lawn looks like, and the factor is why do we still allow this chemically treated plants, because that will definitely crash our population.
Well, it sounds like, as you're saying, that no matter what individual beekeepers do, these pesticides are in use in so many parts of the state that there's only so much that, you know, an individual beekeeper can control. But speaking of those controls, we actually have on the line Chip Troiano, who's a representative for the Hardwick, Stannard, and Walden regions. Chip, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
I can, yes. So could you tell us, I believe you've sponsored some of these bills that would limit these harmful chemicals. Is that right?
Yes. It was, back in 2018, I sponsored a bill. I was the lead sponsor of a bill that actually did ban neonicotine pesticides from the shelves of the hardware stores. So the Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets is monitoring it and has an enforcement in place that will that has taken these pesticides off the shelves of the hardware stores in Vermont. Mm-hmm. We found that, you know, these beautiful packaging with, grow beautiful roses really had this poisonous element to them. And people really didn't know that they were poisonous. So a lot of these applications, yard applications, were such that people didn't know. So they are no longer available. This year, we did get a bill. I co-sponsored a bill with Representative Shelburne from Middlebury, and that was also to research the effectiveness of treated seeds. What we do find is that there is no real good evidence that these seeds really enhance crop growth, because they're the only things, the only seeds that are available. And so what you find is farmers buy the seeds and they put them in the ground and they grow. And they have no idea whether non-treated seeds would actually be as effective. So we've got the Agency of Agriculture again looking into this, and we could not ban treated seeds. That wasn't going to work. Agency of Agriculture didn't support that. And untreated seeds, we find, are relatively unavailable. So this bill will actually ask seed companies to make the non-treated seeds more available to farmers, and then will help some farmers experiment as to whether or not these treated seeds are as effective as they may think.
Well, Representative Troiano, thanks so much for sharing on these the bills that you've been sponsoring to try to protect bees. Chaz Mraz, I know you've also been involved with these efforts. What, you know, now that this most recent bill, H-626, got pretty watered down, what are you hopeful for? What efforts are you looking towards now that could help protect the bees in your apiaries?
Well, you know, we do everything on the management end we can to keep our bees healthy, but it's gotten beyond our control. And, you know, we're doing mite treatments, we're doing everything we need to do on our end to keep our bees alive, and it's still not being effective. We've had terrible losses. You know, I think the awareness really has to be about these environmental impacts of these pesticides. And you mentioned, you know, the farmers testified against it. Some did, but I think a lot of them don't really know what's going on with these seeds. In fact, these chemicals are working against them, trying to improve their soils. A lot of the technological things we're doing to improve soil quality, you end up planting these seeds and the plant only absorbs about 5% of the chemical on the seed. 95% ends up in the soil. It's water soluble and it travels from that field to other fields. It travels throughout the field. It travels into waterways. And we're talking about a chemical that's been linked to a major decrease in bird populations, major decreases in insect populations in general. And it's, and affecting aquatic species as well. There's a, you know, just a plethora of science on these chemicals that is very negative. And I don't think the farmers really truthfully want any part of it if they knew what was actually going on here. You know, this is not good for agriculture as a whole. It's not even good for them. It's detrimental to their soils. It's killing all the earthworms, beetles, microbes in their soil that they're trying to increase. And I think really some of them should have to should take a look at the amount of fertilizer usage they've needed in order to make up for this loss of quality soil.
Well, we are out of time for our conversation today. Chaz Mraz is a third generation beekeeper at Champlain Valley Apiaries. Chaz, thanks so much for joining the show today. We were also joined by Spencer Hardy, a bee biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies.